convinced that it was essential that we looked at George Whitefield this week, because George Whitefield is without a doubt one of the most important people imaginable in church history, especially in the United States history. He was the first public figure known in the United States aside from royalty. He is the first person who united all the colonies in the United States on anything. He was the first celebrity in America. He spoke to the largest groups of people ever seen anywhere on the North American continent. And he did this, of course, without PA systems or electronics or anything other than his voice. He could speak to 30,000 people outdoors just by the power of his voice, as Benjamin Franklin tested and estimated. He was a Calvinist, an evangelist, and a revivalist. George Whitefield was the most famous religious figure of the 18th century. And the astounding thing is he's very little known today. That's right. He founded the Methodist Church. George Whitefield was described by his contemporaries as the marvel of his age. And it's a marvel that he's been so forgotten, because the 18th century was dramatically impacted by him. Whitefield was an eloquent preacher who electrified his audiences. He drew some of the greatest crowds ever assembled up to that time across two continents without any institutional support, through prayer and through the sheer power of his personality. There was no advanced team. There was no organization. He had no pentechnicons coming in or wagons in order to set up all the crews. And this was a man who walked around, and towards the end he had a fold-up pulpit, a little wooden fold-down pulpit that he could carry under his arm. But aside from that, there was no equipment. There was nothing between him and his audience. There was no notes. There was no pulpit between him. He was standing between him and the crowd, often a hostile crowd, preaching gospel. And the great evangelical awakening that swept across the British Isles and North America in the 18th century has been attributed primarily to the dynamic ministry of George Whitefield. And it's an astounding thing that he has faded from a lot of the history books who try to ignore this man, who at that time was the colossus who overshadowed all others. Probably not since Luther and Calvin has there been such a vessel chosen for bearing the errands of mercy to the multitude. By the power of the Holy Spirit, he changed sterile religious wastes into verdant heavenly pastures. And he sowed on good ground those seeds of practical piety, whose fruit bless and encourage us in the institutions and habits that have been handed down to us from Christianity of past generations. And that's one historian's quote on Whitefield. Imagine comparing this man to Luther and Calvin. What is it about him that we have not fully appreciated? George Whitefield was born the youngest of seven children at Gloucestershire, the son of an innkeeper. His father died when he was just 2 years old. His mother remarried, but that resulted in a disastrous divorce. His mother, Elizabeth Whitefield, struggled to maintain the Bell Inn, which she had inherited, with George mopping floors, cleaning rooms, serving customers food and drink. So he was effectively a servant from his youngest years. Whitefield later recalled how his mother endured 14 weeks sickness after giving birth to him, and that she had often said to him that she expected more out of him than out of all of her other children. George expressed his desire to follow the example of my dear Savior, who was born in a manger belonging to an inn. He saw the connection. Through the efforts of his mother, young Whitefield was able to enter Pembroke College in Oxford as a servitor. That means as a servant. So he would work his way through college by serving the wealthier Oxford students. And this was in lieu of being able to pay fees, so he would serve his whole way through. And of course, the class structure of England at that time would have been very acute, and he would have been treated as a servant, and he was often very much humbled and humiliated. Initially, he wasn't accepted by the Holy Club because they were upper class and he was not. Even before he arrived at Oxford, he had heard of the Holy Club. That's what became the Methodists, which John and Charles Wesley were running. And they were generally despised and ridiculed by most of the students. George felt strongly drawn to defend them in argument long before he became one of them, before he even became a Christian. In time, Whitefield was welcomed to the Holy Club, and he sought to live by their strenuous rules. At this time, while reading The Life of God and the Soul of Man, written by Henry Scougal, Whitefield declared, "God has shown me that I must be born again." George later commented that at Oxford it became clear that he was no scholar, but that he was called to be a communicator of the gospel. He determined to be a missionary to America. However, his great devotional excesses and his lengthy fastings broke down his health, and he was laid aside by long and wearisome sickness. When Whitfield recovered, Dr. Benson, the Bishop of Gloucestershire, offered him ordination as a deacon. And after a short time as a temporary pastor to a congregation in Hampshire, Whitfield sailed for America. He had already risen to great prominence as a public speaker. Huge crowds had gathered in and around London whenever he spoke. Newspaper articles had been written concerning the sensation of the boy preacher, and his intense and emotional presentations of biblical characters and stories were attended by huge crowds and unprecedented emotional responses. Now, at that stage, Anglican pastors were very stiff, starchy, stuffy, unemotional, and it was considered very important to be dignified, and things were presented in a very stiff way. And the way Whitfield preached was so revolutionary, and he preached to the heart, and he was so more emotional and so much more intense in how he dealt with it, that it created an absolute sensation. And of course, he was criticized heavily. The first sermon he preached at age 21, one deacon complained to the local bishop that 15 people had gone insane as a result of Whitfield's preaching. What he meant is they'd repented of their sins, but he called it insane. So here's attacked from the very, very beginning. Well, before departing for America, Whitfield published his first message, The Nature and the Necessity of a Regeneration or New Birth in Jesus Christ. This picture is of a group of people who had attended one of Whitfield's gatherings, and afterwards all took turns ridiculing and mimicking him. And this one man, as he stood up and he picked up the Bible, and he is about to imitate the way Whitfield had done this to make fun of him, his eyes fell upon the verse, "Unless you repent, you too will all likewise perish." And conviction hit him, and he suddenly was overcome with conviction. He repented, and he became a dedicated Christian, went to the ministry, and it started when he was trying to ridicule Whitfield. It's just one of the interesting stories behind him. Well, in Georgia, Whitfield preached 5 times a week to crowded congregations, and multitudes followed him. When he returned to London, churches were opened on weekdays, and constables had to be placed at the doors to prevent too many people from forcing their way into the buildings, and at Bermondsey Church, nearly 1,000 people stood outside the church, unable to hear his message. Whitfield felt strong compulsion to go out and preach to this crowd from the tombstones, as is depicted in this historic sketch, which is contemporary. This was the beginning of his open-air preaching. Soon, at Kingswood near Bristol, Whitfield began his field preaching to about 200 coal miners, and this is the picture of this preaching to coal miners, the beginning of his open-air meeting. 200 came. The second day, he preached, 2,000 people assembled to him. The third time, the audience had risen to 5,000. The numbers gathered increased until more than 20,000 people were assembled to hear the speaker in the fields at one time. And they could all hear him. 20,000. Today, we often have preachers who, if there's a power failure, or there's a problem with the PA system, they can't speak, even in a room barely much bigger than twice the size of this that we're meeting now, and they suddenly, the whole service is stalled because the PA system's not working. And Spurgeon often said, if you don't have good lungs and a strong voice, you're not called to preach. Well, that's before PA systems. Now we've got a lot of people who don't develop their lungs and develop their public speaking projection because PA systems make us lazy. We just can mumble and whisper, and the person in the back row can hear with the new systems. But imagine if we all had to go into the fields and preach to the open crowds, where there's the noise and the bustle of traffic and people heckling, and you don't have a congregation that's gathered with the express purpose of reverently listening to the message, but trying to disrupt you. How many preachers could handle that? But Whitfield was doing this. Although the common people thronged to hear him, the church authorities took great offense at George Whitfield's innovations of preaching the gospel outside of the sanctuary of a church building, and are determined to prevent him preaching from any of their pulpits in future. So what Whitfield had adopted by choice now became a necessity, because the pulpits in England were closed to him, and he had to go into the fields because he had gone to the fields. Now imagine, what do those churches think when they read about Jesus preaching the Sermon on the Mount? Where do they think the Apostle Peter preached the Pentecost sermon? Do they think it was in some nice church where everyone was sitting in pews? Really, the mentality When they work their way through the scripture, what are these churches thinking? To outlaw preaching of the gospel outside of a church building. How do they think the church buildings existed? The church building came first and then people got converted afterwards. The whole mentality was so twisted at that stage, they'd lost the idea of where the gospel had come from. Hence, there needed to be a great evangelical awakening. They were great-great-grandchildren of the Reformation. They'd forgotten what they were there for and how they got there. And Whitfield had been called by God to now innovate this extemporaneous preaching. At first, with no wooden pulpit, even sermon notes between him and his congregation, this seemed revolutionary. It was undignified to the established church. It was at this point, early 1738, that George Whitfield concluded that his calling was to be an itinerant preacher to the urban areas throughout the Anglo-American world. And it was during his great preaching tour of the American colonies in 1739 to 1740 that the great evangelical awakening erupted. It was his second trip to America, but it was his first speaking tour. The previous time he was just in Georgia, but now he's going everywhere. Whitfield's first stop was Philadelphia, a major port city, the most cosmopolitan city in the New World, with a thriving market economy. At every stop along Whitfield's ministry tour from Philadelphia to New York and back in, record audiences, often exceeding the population towns in which he preached, assembled. And this is his collapsible pulpit that was made by a carpenter for him to fold up and take, so he could be at least above the crowd and have better opportunity to project and people could hear, but he could fold down the whole thing and literally carry it under his arm. Observers reported on the remarkable phenomenon of spellbound audiences listening in profound silence in greater numbers than had ever been seen up to that point in North America. Some of the most dramatic spiritual responses occurred during Whitfield's 39-day whirlwind tour of New England. On the 17th of October, 1740, Whitfield preached in Northampton, Massachusetts, and he stayed with the famed theologian Jonathan Edwards, the other great theologian and figure associated with the great evangelical awakening in North America. Jonathan Edwards was considered the greatest theologian. In fact, some said he's the greatest academic and mind that America's ever produced. And many secular historians even acknowledge there's no greater philosopher and mind that America's produced up till this time than Jonathan Edwards. And he's the one who, of course, preached that famous Sinners in the Hands of an Angry God sermon. Edwards reported the congregation was extraordinarily melted, almost the whole assembly being in tears for a great part of the time, which included himself. It was after that visit that Edwards preached his famous sermon, Sinners in the Hands of an Angry God, that absolutely exploded the conviction of sin and the revival that swept throughout North America. Sarah Edwards, who was a very critical thinker herself, observed that Whitfield aimed more at the heart, at affecting the heart, than the preachers she had heard up to that time. By proclaiming the simple truths of the Bible, he affected the heart more than any other preacher she had ever heard. And she had heard a lot. She was a well-traveled, intelligent, and well-gifted speaker. And so that's the picture of Sarah Edwards and this of Jonathan Edwards. Notice at that stage the practice of the men wearing wigs. The hair was short, but they'd wear these longer wigs for whatever reason they thought that it somehow improved dignity. And so you'd have a young man, even in his 20s, like Whitfield, with grey-haired wig. And I'm not too sure what the purpose was, but this was to them probably like wearing a hat. It was on the second ministry tour of America that Whitfield acquired a 500-acre plot for his Bethesda orphanage's House of Mercy. That's what Bethesda means. It was 10 miles north of Savannah, Georgia. And by 1740, he had nearly 40 children under his care. But it was at this point, while revival was breaking out in New England, that a disagreement arose between Whitfield and his trustees, who all withdrew their support. Then his supplies bound for the orphanage were stolen. Of course, no insurance. So soon Whitfield owned about £500, which was about 20 years' wages at that time. A crippling expense. By the way, this was the first charity ever opened in North America, and Whitfield opened it. Then his primary sponsor for the endeavor, William Seward, who had encouraged him to set up this orphanage and promised the money behind it, he died without a will. And Whitfield reported, "I was embarrassed with Mr. Seward's death. He died without making any provision for me. And I was at the same time much indebted for the orphan house. I'm almost tempted to wish I'd never undertaken an orphan house." It became an absolute burden upon him. The debt against Bethesda placed Whitfield in jeopardy of being jailed for unpaid debt. At that time, in accordance with biblical principles of you are accountable for your debts, you could go to jail if you didn't pay your debts. Not paying your debts was serious. You couldn't just say, I declare bankruptcy. As they do today, you'd go to jail for not paying your debts, because that's a serious thing. And the financial burdens associated with this orphanage, Whitfield described as lying like dead weight upon me. It was only 28 years later, in 1768, that Whitfield finally managed to settle the debt. It took him 28 years to pay off this crippling debt, and all the time there was the danger and threats of going to jail. So he had 28 years of this misery over him because of this debt which just happened through taking this on with the encouragement of someone who said he'd provide the financial backing, and that man died without a will. With the revival sweeping England and North America, Whitfield now sailed for Scotland. And in 1742, Whitfield's preaching was received with great enthusiasm in Glasgow and Edinburgh. Whitfield's evening service attracted thousands and continued until 2 a.m. in the morning. I mean, how many churches would get away with doing that often? There were scenes of uncontrollable distress, like a battlefield. All night in the fields might be heard the voices of prayer and praise. And people couldn't get to bed. They just couldn't sleep. They were so overcome with conviction of sin. This man preached sin and preached repentance and preached the scripture in such a powerful way that people were absolutely stricken. Whitfield commented that the responses in Scotland far outdid all that I ever saw in America. At one service, 20,000 people attended a meeting that stretched late into the night. On Sunday, Whitfield served communion in the fields, and thousands poured past the tables in open fields. And it was reported that wherever you walked, you might have heard persons praying to and praising God. Whitfield made 14 ministry trips to Scotland and 7 to America. And let me remind you how primitive the travel would have been. The roads weren't that good. He rode on horseback at first, and later in his life, he had a little two-wheeled carriage being pulled by a single horse. And in America, it would have also been horses. And then, of course, wooden ships crossing the Atlantic. This is hard travel. This would have been very, very exhausting for him. Well, early in his ministry, a sharp conflict developed between John Wesley and George Whitfield. When Whitfield left England in 1739, he was the recognized leader of the Evangelical Awakening. He then entrusted his thousands of converts to John Wesley's care. He was the founder of the Methodist Church. When he returned to England in early 1741 from America, he found that many of my spiritual children will neither hear, see, nor give me the least assistance. Yes, some of them even sent threatening letters, damning him to hell, and so on. John Wesley had preached and published against the teachings of George Whitfield in predestination and total depravity. So as soon as George Whitfield left town, John Wesley started to publish all kinds of attacks on him. And this Whitfield found out when he landed in America. Wesley rejected Whitfield's Calvinist convictions and held that sinless perfection was attainable in this life. You could reach a stage where you would no longer sin and you'd be perfect in this life before the Lord came or called, which the doctrine of total depravity denies. This is an Arminian position, and on predestination he also wrote the most vicious attacks, accusing Whitfield of blasphemy and of callousness and of hating people, and it was a very unsober attack. Now, Whitfield had always respected John Wesley as a spiritual father in Christ, and he was a senior, as elder. He addressed Wesley in his letters as honored sir. And although Whitfield's evangelistic successes far outstripped that of his former instructor, he continued to show John Wesley great respect to the very end of his life, and he even requested that John Wesley preach a sermon at his own funeral, which shows a tremendous grace. However, the Arminianism of John Wesley was so hostile to Whitfield's Calvinist convictions. In March 1739, while Whitfield was in America, Wesley preached and published a passionately Arminian sermon called Free Grace. He testified that this step was only taken with great unease and after seeking a sign from heaven and drawing lots twice. It's a very bizarre way of determining God's will, but he drew lots. Wesley feared that Calvinism would discourage growth in holiness, and Wesley ensured that Free Grace was not only published throughout England, but even in America, which forced Whitfield to write a response because this was undermining his support in America, condemning him to be a heretic and so on. Despite some hot tempers and hard words and exchanges, George Whitefield and John Wesley were actually ultimately reconciled. And I've heard some preachers saying what a disgrace it was how Wesley and Whitefield were on one another like cat and dog, and with no acknowledgement of the fact that they did reconcile. Not that there was any agreement on the two issues of predestination or perfection, but they agreed to disagree. And Whitefield then refused to build Calvinist Methodist chapels in places that already had a Methodist society of Wesley, and Wesley agreed the same, not to build his societies in the same areas where Whitefield already had a tabernacle. So Whitefield was welcome to preach at many of Wesley's societies, like Wesley's foundry pictured here. And more than once, Whitefield acted as a mediator when the Wesley brothers fell out, notably when Charles sabotaged John's marriage prospects to Grace Murray. That was a serious breakdown, and Whitefield was the one who pulled the brothers back together again when John was ready to kill Charles. In 1749, Whitefield resigned formal leadership of the Calvinist Methodist societies and posed no further threat to Wesley as the chief organizer of the revival in England. And this diffused things nicely, because with Whitefield taking no denominational leadership, Wesley felt much more positive towards Whitefield. And Wesley lent Whitefield one of his best preachers, Joseph Cowney, to minister at the Tabernacle in London, which is pictured here. This is a church that was founded by Wesley, and it was a massive church, one of the first of the mega churches in England. Whitefield also laid the foundations for the Kingswood College, Bristol, which became so important to Methodism. He founded the college, actually. So Wesley did some things to help Whitefield. Whitefield did quite a lot to help Wesley, and both of them came to a gracious position. And in fact, John Wesley even preached a very powerful sermon at the funeral of Whitefield and honored him in his memory. So although it was a very ugly break at one point, we can praise God that it was healed to some degree. Now, another interesting friendship that you wouldn't have expected was that between George Whitefield and Benjamin Franklin. Because Benjamin Franklin was plainly on opposite end of the theological spectrum from George Whitefield. Benjamin Franklin proclaimed a religious creed which consisted primarily of good works. He was a deist, and he had a good works kind. If you read his maxims, it's all good stuff, but it's works-based religion. Whitefield's last public words, the very last words that he preached within hours of his death, were works, works. A man gets to heaven by works. I would as soon think of climbing to the moon on a rope of sand. And you can see Whitefield, eloquent to the last, he rejected the works-based religion, and Benjamin Franklin rejected the faith. He wanted the works. So they were on totally opposite ends of the theological spectrum. Yet Benjamin Franklin and George Whitefield went way beyond a partnership in publishing. That's where it started. Because Franklin was a publisher. Whitefield was a sensation. By publishing Whitefield's sermons, he got a lot of subscribers to his publications and magazines. And this is great. So Benjamin Franklin was making money out of publishing the things preached by Whitefield, even though he didn't exactly believe them all. Whitefield was benefited by Franklin, because Franklin was getting his sermons and his messages spread so far and wide that he is increasing the attendances, the converts, the extent of the gospel reach. So it was a good partnership where they both benefited. One was a publisher, the other was a preacher, and so there was a mutual benefit in working together. But it did grow to friendship, a real friendship, a genuine friendship of mutual trust and respect. And when the colonial tensions with the mother country, England, arose, Whitefield clearly sided with the Americans, which as an Englishman is amazing. When Benjamin Franklin appeared before the Parliament in England, Whitefield attended every session, gave his old friend public support, which was significant because he was so respected in England. Whitefield's support went a long way. Benjamin Franklin, from his side, commended Whitefield's evangelistic zeal and charitable ministries enthusiastically. And once he wrote to Whitefield, encouraging him to organize a strong body of religious and industrious people to settle Ohio. Might it not greatly facilitate the introduction of pure religion among the heathen if we could, by such a colony, show them a better example of Christians than they commonly see in our Indian traders? So Whitefield might not have been a dedicated Christian himself, but he saw the benefit of having Christian workers, Christian settlers, and he was concerned for the conversion of the heathen for his own purposes, because it would make a better, more stable society. So he may not have been a Christian, but he could recognize real Christianity versus the false. And Perhaps this honesty of Benjamin Franklin endeared itself to Whitfield, and they worked together on a number of projects. Some historians attribute the advent of black Christianity in America to George Whitfield's first preaching tour in Philadelphia, when he sought out audiences of slaves, preached the gospel to them, and wrote on their behalf. Now, interestingly, while Wesley opposed slavery, Whitfield supported slavery. Whitfield was not against slavery, but he wanted the slaves evangelized, he wanted them converted, he wanted them brought into church, and he saw no reason to put any obstacles before them, and they should share the same Lord's Supper and so on. But he said, you've got to have slavery, because some people are slaves by nature. They are slaves to alcohol, they're slaves to laziness, and those people who are not industrious and self-controlled and self-disciplined are naturally slaves anyway, and if they're slaves of sin, they might as well be slaves of man, and if it's a Christian slave owner, then he can be a good example, bring them up, and this will be good for them. So Whitfield was not against slavery, but he was for the slaves being thoroughly converted and evangelized, where he could see them getting out of slavery by being brought into the gospel, being discipled, that they could reach a stage where they could survive outside of slavery. But he did not foresee that people who were not Christians from this kind of indolent and witchcraft background could possibly succeed outside of a benevolent slavery. And so he even bought slaves, had huge plantations which were to provide for his orphanage and to be able to care for the people, but they were well treated. Now, some people want to make something of this and attack Whitfield over the fact that Whitfield didn't oppose slavery, but you've got to remember what these people are coming from and the conditions. And this is 2.5 centuries ago, and he's looking at this and saying, these people are not ready to run things on their own. So he wasn't after mistreating them, he was after evangelizing and having a benevolent ownership which would lift them up until he looked forward to the time in future generations when they may be able to stand their own feet and run their own households well. But in the meantime, he said, people who are enslaved to sin are going to be enslaved to man. It's just a natural law of nature. And Wesley attacked him on that too, so there was another disagreement on this point. One of Whitfield's classic open-air preaching battles occurred in 1746 in the Moorfields of London. This is where the big games took place. And on Whitsun, which was a holiday, he began preaching at 6 in the morning when some 10,000 people had assembled. I find hard to believe you had 10,000 people assembling at 6 in the morning in London, but apparently they do this. Waiting for the sports events to begin, Whitfield came and he preached 3 times for many hours during the day in spite of drummers, hecklers, trumpeters, players, hecklers, vulgar attacks with people throwing stones and dirt, rotten eggs, pieces of dead animals, all manner of filth was thrown at him. And this is depicted here. You can actually see there's someone in a tree there with his trumpet, and this one here is aiming a gun, and he kept firing this musket past his ear to unnerve him, and this man is playing his drums, and he had all kinds of revelry and heckling. But you see some people are praying around and seeking to uphold him. He had a few prayer warriors with him. So this was, he deliberately went into the place where the vile masses who were irreligious were gathering. He knew they wouldn't be in church on this holy day, and so he decided to go in, and he was going to preach gospel to these people, and it was absolutely wild. A recruiting sergeant marched his men straight through the middle of the audience in the hope of making a disturbance. Whitfield requested his people to fall back, make way for the king's officers. And then they closed in again after him. And this maneuver trapped the men within a mass of worshippers. And when the uproar of the heathen became so great that Whitfield couldn't be heard, he stopped preaching, called for the Christians to sing with loud voices. And so with singing, praying, and preaching, he held the field throughout the day. And this is classic Whitfield. Go where you're not wanted and preach the gospel so powerfully that they have to give in, and they did. More than 1,000 letters were handed to him by persons who were brought under conviction of sin, and 350 people joined his congregation, came to Christ and joined his congregation, the tabernacle, as a result of that one day's preaching. That's not just some kind of hands raised, letters written, and people who joined the congregation as a result. 350, one day's preaching to a hostile audience, with no preparation. There's no, you know, advanced team for the George Whitfield Evangelistic Association coming in, and or nothing like this. But he could go in one day, and there were a lot of prayer warriors with him. I mean, it wasn't that he was totally alone, but But imagine being able to do that without a PA system, without an organization stage, no bouncers and bodyguards. And he just went in and he took Moorfields. And this was the classic of classics. This is Whitfield at his very best. In his lifetime, Whitfield preached at least 18,000 times, it was calculated. He would preach an average of 12 times a week, and he spent 20 to 50 hours a week in the pulpit. By the pulpit, we mean this little outside portable. Whitfield was America's first celebrity, and about 80% of all American colonists heard him preach at least once. 80%. Imagine reaching 80% of a country. Brutal mobs of non-Christians sometimes attacked Whitfield and his followers. Here you can see a ridiculing newspaper article of the people going insane while he dangles an angel on one side and a demon on the other. And it's just bizarre attack on him. And I think it's got the deadly sins listed down here and so on. Whitfield received death threats by letters. And once he was stoned until nearly dead. In his lifetime, he was declared the greatest preacher that England had ever produced, and was calculated that he preached to over 10 million people in his lifetime. 10 million people. Imagine doing that without radio, without any of the technological advances we have, by his own voice, unaided, and normally out in the open, without advertising, except such that the press provided by hostile attacks, and occasionally positive reports like from Benjamin Franklin. It was calculated that he would usually wake up around 4 in the morning and he'd begin preaching at 5 or 6 a.m. And amazingly, people were turning out for 5 and 6 o'clock a.m. services. I don't know how many of us would have wanted to turn up at that time, but you can see here pictured some of the attacks that Whitfield had to endure from people for preaching. Not everyone thanks you for telling them the gospel. John Wesley is known as the founder of the Methodist movement. Few people remember that it was actually George Whitfield who formed the first Methodist societies and who pioneered all of the methods used in the 1700s evangelical awakenings. It was Whitfield that pioneered preaching in the fields rather than churches. And he's the first to publish magazines. Do you know that? Magazines being published was a George Whitfield innovation, helped, of course, by Benjamin Franklin. He also published the first magazine in North American history, which was Christian History, which contained authentic accounts of the most remarkable passages, historical and doctrinal, from famous Christians of the past. And by the way, he's the first to begin conferences, holding conferences, which I'm afraid is much in abuse today, but there are good conferences that have been held over the years. Think of the Keswick conferences and others. He was the one who started those traditions. So Whitfield should be more known and appreciated than he is. Interesting, there's a magazine today called Christian History, but he started the first Christian History magazine back in the States in the 1740s. Whitfield pushed himself so hard and he preached with such intensity that he was frequently ill afterwards. I mean physically ill after preaching. He had put so much into it. Aside from preaching an average of 12 times a week, Whitfield sometimes conducted funerals and performed weddings. He often counseled in choirs. He oversaw numerous congregations. He maintained a large correspondence, as well as organizing his charitable endeavors, which were many. And he preached at conferences, which Lady Huntington organized, for example, of nobles. And these were described as times of refreshing from the presence of our God. Mr. Whitfield's sermons and exhortations were close, searching, experimental, awful, and awakening. That's how Lady Huntington described it. By the way, when John Newton came out of his slave trading background, and he was converted, he sought out George Whitfield, and he had to wait over a day for him to give him 5 minutes, and then he had to excuse himself for other business and dashed off. And John Newton described this 5 minutes with Whitfield as just how important and vital it was in guiding him, and amazing. You can hardly imagine how much distraction he'd get. Everywhere he's going, there are people who wanted his opinions, wanted his help, wanted his counsel, and so on. And Whitfield was continually without opportunity to rest. Yet despite all that he achieved amidst physical trials and spiritual labors, Whitfield wrote on the occasion of his 37th birthday, "I am ashamed to think I've lived so long and done so little." Which makes the rest of us wonder, what can we say? If this man could have done so much and felt that he hadn't done enough, He just was driven to keep preaching the gospel to more people who hadn't heard it. By the way, pictured here is his wife, and I'm afraid that Whitfield is not an example in how to have a happy marriage. He had a bizarre solution to his problems. He had someone he was passionately in love with, convinced this would undermine his ministry, and he shared this with another friend of his who is also passionately in love with someone about to get married, and agreed for the problem, so they decided they'd swap fiancés. So that they'd married someone they didn't like, because they thought this would be better for the ministry. Absolutely bizarre, and it happened. And here's his wife pictured here, who he respected greatly, but to his dying days he missed this woman that he hadn't married, who he wanted to, and his friend had done the same. Something weird, who knows how to explain this, but he did not have a very happy wife, and he was away from her for most of any given year anyway, traveling. She couldn't keep up with the pace of traveling. So it just reminds us of the fact that you can have people who are absolutely outstanding and great in many ways. He had 5 children, all of which died. 4 died in childbirth, and 1 died just, I forget if it was at age 2 or 4, but it was very young. His 5th child died young. He preached 3 sermons that day before the funeral, and he had to be summoned and pulled from the pulpit where he was preaching outside when a bell was tolling to make it to his son's funeral. This was someone who was so completely focused on his preaching ministry. He does not present to us a good example of how to have a successful marriage. But then neither did John Wesley, who also has an absolute debacle of a disastrous mess to point to, and his brother Charles certainly contributed in that by sabotaging his one real best chance of marrying the right person, and he ended up also in one of these horrible mismatches.
Maybe,
so,
maybe that's why Paul suggested to be eunuchs.
Well, I do not know what to make of it, but I must say, you get people like Whitfield and Wesley, and you see so many things that are just such spectacular examples, and then you look at their family life and you think, how could they have so dropped the ball on this, and how could it have been such a mess? Who on earth comes out with ideas like, the person I'm passionately in love with and want to marry can't be good for my ministry, so, you know, let's swap. And how did these women put up with this? How could they possibly settle for this? Absolutely weird, but I think we've got to also think of what the British mentality was. The whole attitude was duty. Duty first, foremost, uppermost. That was the most important thing. And so the idea was, I can't possibly allow myself to do what I really want to do, because that would get in the way of my duty. And as duty is your first responsibility, they would sacrifice what they saw as their own happiness because they wanted to be more effective. And this was, that's about as close as I can get to understanding what was going on in their minds, because they hardly wrote about their feelings, you can imagine. So we can only guess. Many times Whitfield traveled through torrential rain and blizzards of snow in order to make his appointments. And much of his correspondence, his reading and his study was accomplished while traveling, which means on the back of a horse. Oh, if you're in a boat, wonderful, even if you're getting a bit seasick at the time. And then in later in life, when he was allowed the luxury of a little carriage with 2 wheels being spun on these bad roads behind 1 horse, he would do a lot of his writing and reading and correspondence while bouncing around on the cobbled roads or whatever they had in Britain. So most of his correspondence and study was while traveling. His secretary said, I don't know that Mr. Whitfield knew anything about preparing sermons. He said, not aware that he ever had notes for a sermon. The man preached extemporaneously. He was soaked in the scriptures. He was soaked in particular Matthew Henry's commentaries. And he was very much, he knew the 39 articles by heart. He had Calvin's Institutes absolutely memorized in large parts. And so he was soaked in a lot of materials in the writings of the Puritans. But he didn't have notes. He would get in the pulpit and he would preach. He'd take a text and he would expound it. And he especially centered around personalities, and he centered around stories in the Bible. And he would preach, and he would preach to people's hearts so that they were so convicted. And he would weep, and he was criticized. How can you weep in a pulpit? That's unbecoming of a minister to show such emotion in a pulpit. And he said, how can I not weep for you when you will not weep for yourselves? You know, he had very un-English. You can see why the Americans loved him more, because, well, the Americans are far more demonstrative than the English are not. But he still shook the English up. And he did all this amongst a throng of business, because there were all sorts of things, including creditors demanding his blood for unpaid debts. So frequently Whitfield ignored the advice of doctors, and in his last year he continued his 1770 preaching tour in America, declaring, "I would rather wear out than rust out." Which is a nice thought, but as Bill Bethman says, either way you're out. It's better not to rust out or wear out. Can't you have a middle path where you, which is the necessary vehicle to proclaim the gospel? If we wear ourselves out till we die in our 40s or 50s, we have cut off how many decades of good ministry, which is just because we didn't take care of what God gave us. I am convinced that if many of the reformers that we could point to, if they cared for their bodies more, they could have lived longer and been more effective. I think, for example, of David Brainerd. David Brainerd died at 29 after a few months in the field with a handful of converts of tuberculosis. He didn't care for his body at all. He burned out. And he was... True. Spurgeon is another example, although in a different way. But they could not think of wasting time with exercise or health or things like this. They were so dedicated in this. And for generations, David Brainerd has been lifted up as an example. He inspired William Carey and many others, and Jonathan Edwards' almost father-in-law, because he died while engaged to his daughter, being cared for in Edwards' home. He wrote the book on the diary of David Brainerd. And even though this man absolutely destroyed his health and died years before he needed to, Christians at that time looked up to him as a wonderful sacrificial example to follow. And the idea of just absolutely devastating your health through sacrificial service was seen as a perfect ideal. Now, I don't think that is commonly held today. These days we're looking at thinking, if you have to die for Christ, then you do it with joy. But to die because you didn't care for your health, I don't see the honor in that. I think that's just missed opportunity and decades of ministry that's been lost. So I think while God has numbered our days, we still commanded to look after the temple of the Holy Spirit. And I do not think it's commendable to follow the example of someone, even though I can respect and honor these reformers and evangelists so much, I don't see them as an example in how to run a family. I certainly don't see them as an example of how to look after your body and your health. On those two issues, I personally think they failed, if I can dare say so, as someone who isn't worthy to untie their shoelaces. But still, I think that the mentality of I'd rather wear out than rust out, it shows dedication, but it's not wise. Yes. There's so much in that where a man ruins his own life, and his foolishness ruins his life, Proverbs says, yet he rages against the Lord. And so often people blame, how can God allow this? And you think of the people who have done extremely foolish things. I'm just thinking of when I was doing crisis counseling in Hillbrow, and there was some woman who had a completely deformed child, real problem, and she had been on LSD while pregnant. And she is, how could God allow this? Excuse me, you were on an extremely destructive drug while pregnant. How can you blame God for what you are obviously personally responsible for? And there are people like that. There's those who are absolute alcoholics. And a child is born with, fetal alcohol syndrome and so on. And are they going to blame God for their faults? If I'm on my cell phone while driving the car and fiddling for something else in the cubby and I crash the car, can I blame God that I wasn't paying attention to the road? I'd look at it like that. So I feel bad saying anything critical of these men, but I think that we are meant to recognize that there's so much good, but every single one of God's saints has got a flaw or two. And we just mustn't follow every example, and that's why early in my Christian walk, where I also had this mentality of, I'd rather wear out than rust out. And I was ruining my body in my 20s. I was just about finished. I did some extremely foolish things. Just, I didn't care about the body. And David Brainerd was one of my heroes. And I must say, having children changed my way of thinking. Yes. Then you suddenly get a whole new idea about responsibility. Do you want your children to be orphaned? You know, then it puts a different perspective. Well, struggling with breathing, nearly collapsing, needing to be helped onto his horse, Whitfield was heard to pray, Lord, if I have not yet finished my course, let me go and speak for thee once more in the fields, seal thy truth, and then let me come home and die. That he prayed in his last day. And this prayer was answered as he managed to complete one final powerful sermon. And the following morning he died in Newburyport. All the bells in the town tolled, the ships in the harbour fired their cannon warning, flags were hung as half-mast. In Georgia, all the black cloth in all the stores was bought up. The churches were hung in black. The governor and the council met at the State House in deep mourning. They marched in procession to hear the funeral sermon. Poet John Green Whittier described Whitfield as that life of pure intent, that voice of warning yet eloquent. Now, this wasn't a head of a denomination. He wasn't royalty. He was just an itinerant preacher. Just. But what a powerful one. And so all of society recognized that a very great man had passed away. Whitfield has been attributed with pioneering non-denominational ministry, international ministry, parachurch ministry. And in a very real sense, he has. He preached to the heart and he demanded a response. He utilized the media, which was unique. Up to that time, no ministers had really used the media. He blazed the trail which future generations of evangelical revivalists, chaplains, youth and student parachurch leaders and Christian charities have followed. He was the forerunner of what today is considered normal in the sense of revivalists or chaplains or parachurch, interdenominational, international type of ministry. Not that most of those doing this, following his example and the methods, are preaching his message, unfortunately. In many cases, that's why Whitfield's not so popular anymore. Wesley's popular because his message fits with the Arminian society we've got today. Whitfield's not so popular today because he was a Calvinist and he had this hardcore message which really grates these days with the present church climate. By all accounts, those who were awakened by his burning words to a sense of their spiritual needs and who came to Christ as a result of the biblical preaching, they number in at least the hundreds of thousands, at least. Probably the millions, but any conservative estimate would say you've got to at least be talking about hundreds of thousands of people converted through his preaching. And the lives changed by the great evangelical awakening launched through his itinerant preaching ministry are absolutely incalculable, because millions were transformed. Backsliders brought back to Christ, half-hearted Christians on fire, pagans converted. And so the people converted who converted others, and the ripple effects, that goes in the millions without any doubt. Here's some of the quotable sayings of George Whitfield. There is not a thing on the face of the earth that I abhor so much as idleness or idle people. Well, you can imagine that. If he thinks that he did so little, you can imagine what he would think of the rest of us. Then he says, God forbid that I should travel with anybody a quarter of an hour without speaking of Christ to them. So he would not have much time for us who can't find the courage or the opportunity to share the gospel with someone who we're with for a few minutes. You've got to preach the gospel every opportunity. And he says, I hope to grow rich in heaven by taking care of orphans on earth. With his abilities, he could have been rich in the theatre or many other things. But he could, in fact, it was suggested to him on some occasions. And he said, I want to get rich in heaven, not on earth. And whoever takes care of the poor, lends to the Lord. And what is true religion? Caring for widows and orphans in their distress. Whatever you did unto one of the least of these, my brethren, you did unto me. So he was very concerned with caring for orphans. How can people say that evangelists aren't concerned for the welfare and the charity of people who are less fortunate? Some of the greatest evangelists in the world, like Whitfield, were thoroughly concerned with charities. In fact, he pioneered the first charity in America. How can you say that a Calvinist won't be an evangelist? The greatest evangelist America's ever seen was a Calvinist. How can you say that the Reformed doctrines are going to lead people to be lukewarm about holiness? This man was passionately concerned with holiness. Young Christians are like little rivulets, he said, that make a large noise and have shallow water. Old Christians are like deep water that make little noise, carry a good load, and give not way. Big noise doesn't necessarily mean that there's much depth. It's a good, interesting point. You can imagine some of these big rivers that can go past so quietly, and some of these little streams of the rock, big rackets. Suffering times are Christians' best improving times, and he certainly had a lot of suffering times. I thought Romans 15:19-20 epitomizes George Whitfield. In mighty signs and wonders, by the power of the Spirit of God, I fully preached the gospel of Christ, and so I've made it my aim to preach the gospel, not where Christ was named, lest I should build another man's foundation. Well, do you have any comments or observations or some other anecdotes that I might have left out on George Whitfield? Yes. Well, imagine being able to speak to 30,000 people in the outdoors. That's extraordinary. Extraordinary. Mm-hmm. You just think how we struggle with, you know, a few hundred in some cases. Struggle. Mm-hmm. I mean, there's some preachers who could not be heard by 50 people in a room without a PA system. So George Whitfield was considered one of the greatest orators of all time. Mm-hmm. And one of the top theatre actors at the time said, I would give, 100 guineas to be able to say, oh, like Mr. Whitfield. However he said that. Pity we don't have recordings of how it sounded. We've just got, you know, the written accounts. How wonderful it would have been if we could have had some tapes of his sermons. Yes. Well, this is it. In fact, Whitfield described himself as one of the least of God's servants. And he had a very small estimation of himself. He was not a proud man. He was a humble man. In fact, he stated at one stage that in his first year of ministry, where suddenly there were crowds attending, he said pride went to his head. And he was humbled before the Lord that he could have allowed some of this glory to come to him when it didn't belong to him. And he was very critical and spoke openly about the sinfulness that came to him. He actually felt pride over some of the results until he realized that this is all of grace. And he was, when he started in his ministry, he was not a Calvinist. But as he started his ministry, he started to read more of the Puritans' books, and he got into Matthew Henry's commentary. When he went to America, he was given more Calvinist material, and his link with Jonathan Edwards deepened his theology too. You can see he enriched Jonathan Edwards, Jonathan Edwards enriched him. And so within the first couple of years, he got deep and deep into the Calvinist thought, and it humbled him. And he often said that he believed that the best benefit of Calvinism is its hostility to any form of pride, because it takes away every possible ground for pride when you recognize it's all of grace and you appreciate the total depravity of man, you appreciate your depravity, and it's God and God alone who gets all the glory for salvation, mine and anyone else's. And he did speak about very harshly about his initial pride in the first year, and I think that was part of his reaction when he started going into the Puritan writers, that he saw his pride lifted up, and he was a humble man thereafter. I'm sorry that we don't have Kerrett here tonight to add a few other things, because he had read so much on this, and he's got these big doorstopper books on George Whitfield that he wanted to share some of the ideas from. So we must pick his brain on a few other anecdotes. Avril. Yes, there are still places that you can go to in Wales and some parts of England today where there's no pub open. There's no pub in the town. And when you ask why, they say, Mr. Whitfield came through here. Yeah. And that's 2.5 centuries ago. And the impact in some of these places, and I've been to some of these places in Wales where the impact of that preaching great evangelical awakening is to this day, and they'll talk about, you know, Whitfield came through as though he was there last month. Can you imagine?
I was in Georgia, which is where he was when he started the Methodist Church, and the county I worked in was a dry county. No alcohol was sold.
Wow. To this day. Yes, well, he certainly worked his way through Georgia a lot. He preached in the 13 colonies very substantially. And Georgia was, I think, his first base. So, yes, that would account for the dry counties.